Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you. Hello, and thanks again for listening to another episode of All Better. I'm your host, Joe Van Wee. Today's guest is my friend, Mike Mizwinski. Better known simply as Mike Miz. Miz is a singer, songwriter, guitarist from Northeast Pennsylvania, known for soulful and energetic live performances. Encouraged by his mother and father to pursue a passion for music, Mike began playing guitar at the age of 7. And started writing songs as early as the age of 10, often performing over 200 shows a year. He's had the privilege to open up for Jason Isbell, Jacob Dylan, Lucas Nelson, Blues Traveler, Derek Trucks, America, Kenny Wayne Shepherd, Felice Brothers, Sean Colvin, Leon Russell, Chris Isaak, Peter Wolf, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, Jackie Green, Railroad Earth, and many more. Rolling Stone magazine called Mike's 2021 single, Virginia, a monster of a rock jammer. His latest album, Only Human, came out on Blackbird record label on 4/14/23 this year. Mike currently resides in Nashville, Tennessee. You can find his music on MikeMizMusic.com. Mike's an old friend, and Mike's a person in long-term recovery. Today we get to catch up on all things and talk about therapy, early recovery, the origins of addiction in one's life, and how that plays to one's creativity, the condition of the sober mind and an addict in recovery, and how sensitive it is to interpret the world. We discuss and explore a lot of these ideas. So let's be Miz.
I remember that.
Miz, when was the last time you heard this lick?
Probably like the month we did it, you know?
So.
That was a fun day.
That was a recording from 2018. You called on the fly. You had the idea for the song. You said you just started writing it. Within 24 hours, there was 11 people you brought to my house, my living room, and you played a New Year's Eve song, and it was in 2018. You know, things were getting really stressful politically, the political climate in our area, in the nation, a lot of this pre-COVID. You shared that in a week. It had 400 shares. I'm looking at it now. It's just at 20,000 views. That was in 2018. The title of that song was called Learn to Love. Was that the last time I saw you?
I think so, man. Yeah. Been a minute.
Yeah. And so did you ever revisit or play that again? That was just kind of, I got to know you prior to that. I saw how you took what was just bugging you out in the public and you made it a song within hours and expressed it with 11 people. Would that be accurate to say that?
Yeah, no, it's funny. You're absolutely right too. It was getting stressful to, you know, the Facebook feed was you know, the political climate and the angst was building. And for me personally, too, I feel like you know, people in my inner circle were bickering and not getting along. And I think I got the idea for that song in the shower, which is a thing that often happens, you know, I feel like, which is funny because I forgot that song existed. But I guess that was a cool way to, yeah, bring all those people together. And, you know, I had just kind of, I think maybe had maybe about a year at that point of doing pretty good and wanted to sort of like, you know, get on a good page with everybody too, you know, I don't know.
So a year prior to that, and I like that you mentioned the shower. That seems to be the think tank for all creatives, or it's like this well of shame. I could, in my addiction, the shower would be where I'd be groaning, thinking, what did I do or say last night? But the shower is a great place for that. But a year prior to that, we were in treatment together.
Yeah.
2016. Yeah. Man, I was all locked up. I probably would have left early if we didn't spend time together. I had a lot of great connection with you.
Yeah, you helped me too. Dude, honestly, man, you might have been like the deciding factor of me going to aftercare. Because you were talking to me, you know, I still remember it clear as day. And I was, you know how it is, right? Like you go in and I'd done my 3 weeks or whatever it was, 4 weeks were coming up. And I was like, man, I got stuff to do. I can't, you know, like, which now just seems so absurd. Yeah. You know, the things that we think we need to go take care of. And you were like, I still remember your exact wording. You're like, hey, Miz, man, maybe you just need to like go on a little sabbatical, you know? Maybe you'll write some music and like you kind of like, I think you might have just been trying to like sell it to me. Like you knew what you were doing.
Well,
and I was like, yeah, you're probably right, man. I could go on a, you know, it's like the self, it's funny, man, to think like the self-importance and the ego and the whatever mind frame I was in at that point, thinking whatever I had going on was so important. And it just seems so, you know, just crazy now to think that, you know, but
wow. That's a lot to consider. Cause it took me a little longer after that. I mean, I just kept manifesting crisis, experiencing somewhat of real crisis. And I didn't get sober for a little while afterwards, but you make a key note there in the sense that when you realize you have substance use disorder or that addiction, you're not treating it like it's this little small problem. And it's in the way of the rest of the things I have to do. Some people really have to realize this is the only problem I need to solve. The rest kind of is okay. If I solve, all my attention goes to solving this.
Yeah.
I wanted to start linear for anyone maybe who's listening that doesn't know you and catch up where you are currently in Nashville. Correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And your career brought you there. And your career has always been music, great music. And I've always felt flattered and kind of lucky to crash into you over a decade ago with Weekender shoots and always getting along, loving your music and the message that and how you carry yourself, what you're always trying to convey. It's pretty much, you know, love, connection, friendship, loss, pain. It's all wrapped up in your uh-huh. music. How did that begin? How would you describe maybe your childhood and growing up? And was there something that occurred that by the time you met alcohol or opioids that you found relief to something that already existed? Would that be a way, or is it a different kind of story?
No, man, it's funny. I've been thinking a lot about that recently. And if you had asked me that question like 2 or 3 years ago, I probably would have just said, oh man, you know, I just had the gene and it just, that's it. I just, you know, got bit by the bug, but I kind of been doing a lot of like inner work and have been working with a therapist, you know, like last year, particularly. And now it's sort of making sense. You know what I mean? Some of it's sort of like, oh, I think there was some stuff going on inside me. I will say that, you know, both my parents definitely love me and, you know, I was lucky to have that going on, but you know, there was things that were difficult that I'm sure, you know, affected the rest of my life or affected how I processed the world. You know what I mean? That now I'm starting to be able to dig into and see, and, it's sort of not a mystery, some, you know, the way that I turned out. Cause I think a lot of the time I was, you know, when you're like me or you, I know you had some sober time and I had some sober time at a point. I had like 4 years sober at one point. And when you lose that and you're just kind of kicking yourself in the ass and just like dwelling on it, that kind of jumping all over, but now everything's kind of making sense to me now. You know what I mean? But I will say that from the first time I drank alcohol or did drugs, which was like drink and smoke weed very close to each other, I immediately, from the first time ever, it completely changed. My whole course of my life completely shifted. It was like nothing that became paramount to everything else. You know, like there was no like gray area whatsoever. It was like on or off.
That's it. So when I hear that story, when it comes to my personal recovery, not my clinical kind of approach at our aftercare, but that rings my bell, because addiction for me is an attempt to solve a problem that already existed. And not unlike you, if I was asked in early recovery or different periods of my recovery, I would answer this question differently. The same way you said that was that, okay, I would say this person's life was harder. I don't have that kind of trauma. And then I started, you know, the last 5 years, you see distinctions. Let's give this word a broader description to big traumas, small traumas, the way things are processed, like you said, the way emotional pain is processed. But what's really keen is anyone who's artistic, which is a lot of people with addiction. And yeah, artistry is almost, it's ingrained. It's not mystery, like a mystery to me. It's ingrained to perception. And the way you relate and see and interact with reality, and that there is severe conflict with the way culture's telling you reality is and the way you're reacting to it could be expressed artistically. Well, for a lot of us, that came from pain.
Like, yeah.
Before artistry isn't cocaine, it's not heroin. There's an immediate button being pushed when I found, you know, alcohol, nicotine. I'm like, oh, something's missing. It's not missing anymore. It wasn't like I was messed up. It was like something was missing. And this was it.
100%. Yeah, man.
So you said your therapy, did that help kind of flush out maybe some ideas of that nature that maybe you didn't reflect on before? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, kind of. You know, what's funny too is like, you know, therapy and some outside stuff also made me realize that like, dude, as you know, I'm sure, but like, you know, getting sober is just the first layer. And there's so many other layers in there with behavior patterns. And once again, the way I perceive the world, the way I interact with the world, the self-destructive things that I do, self-destructive thinking, actions, you know, what precipitated the, going to a therapist too, is like, I'd, you know, gotten sober and then, you know, got into this insane relationship, which any normal person would have just been like, you know, 2 or 3 months in would have just been like, okay, this isn't healthy and I'm going to leave.
But no, dig
for
in.
For me, I
dig
hang in there for like a year and a half longer
Don't
than I
quit.
Should. You know what I mean? And it's like, so yeah, man, it's just trying to, you know, peel all those layers or whatever.
Is there a sadistic side to this? Like I used to flirt with this, that I'm going to run out of creative ideas if my life isn't chaotic, like almost like this Johnny Cash approach to music. Do you have any of that going on in the realm that the well run dry if I'm not writing and expressing music from not only pain, but chaos? Do you carry any of that?
I think I do. And I think it's so deeply rooted that it's almost like a subconscious thing that is so second nature to me that I'm not even aware at times that I'm doing it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's just such in my nature to just like, to just make life really hard for myself. You know what I mean? Like, And then when I see other people that don't have that problem, I'm baffled and amazed by their ability to just sail through, you know, navigate these things like no big deal. And it's like, and I just kind of hang out there. Yeah, I think like here's the thing, dude, by the way, I don't know if you know this, but so I also relapsed when we got out of treatment. I had about a year and change maybe.
Yeah.
And so now I'm just coming up on 4 years again now.
Congrats.
You know, like, so
me too.
You know, it's crazy. Like the, how many times it, what's that?
I'm right behind you. 4 years.
Yeah.
It was like October.
Oh yeah. Yeah. February, man. That's awesome. And it's amazing how many times and how much pain it takes for me to really be able to look at myself honestly and stuff. And like, I think, there's people that get this thing the first time around, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But then there's guys like me who, and now the great thing is I'm able to help the next guy that does this, 'cause I'm not going to be the last guy that relapses or, you know, goes back on it. But anyway, yeah,
and we could do whatever we want. It's a podcast. I want to make a note there and return to it. The idea of being in the music industry, making a living off of your art, but being available as a person in recovery music, what that would look like. But I figured it might be best to start. We both know what addiction feels like when it starts. It feels like real connection. Like, even though, yeah. And when did you feel the connection to music, and what did that look like? Like, did someone else notice your artistry? Did you know you had a different way to perceive the world, or like we were talking about earlier, or did someone pick this trait up in you and kind of help you nurture it?
That's a great question, man. And just to jump back to the thing you just said about connection real quick is like, dude, one of my least favorite sayings is that horrible saying that my best day sober or my worst day sober is better than my best day like drunk or whatever. Yeah. Dude, that saying, I'm baffled when people say it. 'Cause I'm like, did you ever take a hit of acid and drink like a 12 pack?
No,
in the early stages, that's a pretty good day.
Like, that's a World War II vet's quote. You didn't take MDMA and sit on a mountain with 10,000 people.
Right. But anyway, and you know, this, the question you just asked is, it's all interconnected, right? Because I come from a family, which I think, were a lot of musicians on both sides. I mean, my dad is an amazing guitar player, and my aunt and uncle play in the band Old Friends, which if you're from Scranton, yep, and you're in our age or older, you know all about Old Friends, and you've probably seen them play. You know, they're amazing. And the thing about it is my family is full of like just nothing but like loving great people, who most of whom didn't do what I did. The thing is that if it was Christmas, Thanksgiving, New Year's, whatever it was, you know, the guitars come out around Nana's kitchen table and they drink and they have a good time, and it looked awesome. And I just wanted to be part of that so bad when I was a little kid, and I would see them singing and having a good time, and all, you know, half the neighborhood is over there. It was like, I can't wait to do this, you know? But, and you know, so I started practicing and soon enough they were letting me jam. But I think one of the biggest moments for me is my Uncle Paul, Old Friends, has this reunion every year, right? And when we were kids, I mean, they still have it. I guess they have it at Mountain Sky now. But when we were kids, this was the greatest day of the year, period. Like, we looked forward to the Old Friends reunion all year. And it used to be at Hurricane Hills up in, like, Clifford or something. And there was – I'll never forget it, man. There was 1,400 people that showed up to this thing. And when Old Friends took a set break – my uncle let me and my cousin Leah go on stage and play the set break. And we get out on stage, and I was, I think, 11 years old, maybe. And we start playing, you know, and I already knew, you know, Jimi Hendrix albums and stuff. And dude, the people just came off the hill and stood in front. There's a video of it somewhere. I gotta find that. There was that moment for me, and then also because that was life-changing. I mean, there was no question after that experience like what I was going to do with my life, you know. like, you know, when you're like that age and you got you're playing, you know, you're just like,
you're going to sell insurance now. You're going to
sell it. Yeah, no. But also, man, you know, my dad took me, and this is actually a really, really cool story. My dad took me to see the Grateful Dead, like the Grateful Dead with Jerry Garcia twice when I was a little kid. I was 9 and 11 when I saw the Dead. And I got to give it to my dad, man. He was very responsible and wasn't, you know, partaking in any drug activity. Like he, you know, he had his jean jacket on and we got up in there and he like, you know, he took care of me. You know what I mean? It wasn't like this loose, you know, rainbow festival parents type of thing, you know, and I greatly appreciate that to this day, that he was able to let me see that, but still in like a supervised and very, you know, parental way, like here's the Grateful Dead. And dude, when you're 9 years old and you're down on the floor at Giant Stadium and you're watching this guy just hit one note and the whole, you know, dude, it was amazing. It was so, like, it was the coolest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Was that the '80s? Was with Touch of Grey, like
92 and 95.
And your dad, just to, you know, my remembrance of him and meeting him a couple times is, he has the presence of an action hero. He looks like an 80s action star. He's got that chiseled.
Dude, he looks like Chuck Norris.
Doesn't he? Yeah.
He gets mistaken for Chuck Norris, yeah.
And just being around you, I just felt his presence, man. He's just such a warm and guy. So it seems like that was always a really great influence on your story of your life. Seeing that at an early age, and specifically the Grateful Dead, that's unlike any other band's audience in regards to, say, like the Stones or the emergence of the Beatles, but they dissipate. For those long traveling jam bands, they're the first. They're it. They're the band that was the first jam band. And then I think Fish kind of just emerges out of what was left over, an audience that was waiting to go somewhere else, or a younger audience. Why is that specifically different, I think, for musicians who are attracted to the bluegrass, Grateful Dead? How would you describe the difference for someone who didn't understand that?
I think I lost you, brother.
I'm coming right back.
All right.
It just went down. But we're recording. We're back up. It was like cut in and out. My picture's not there.
All good. It could be my internet. I don't know, man. I'm upstairs here. I can still hear you.
Yeah, and it's still recording. I think the camera just went down. So I guess that's a unique way to embrace music, bluegrass, and jam.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, it was also like a lot of the Allman Brothers and Eric Clapton and the Beatles, of course. That was like, that's like my all-time favorite band. But yeah, I mean, I think there was something special about it. There's also something special about you know, being like 9 years old, and I didn't really know what drugs were at that point yet. Maybe it heard inklings of what they might be about or whatever, but man, did people seem really happy at that concert, you know? That's a very unique type of situation, you know, seeing a band like that rather than like your, you know, average like rock and roll band or something, you know, it's like just a unique situation. Yeah. I don't know. It was awesome.
When did you first get drawn to write and compose your own music? Like, when did that first begin?
I think that began here's another part of that question that you asked a minute ago, which I often think about recently, is that I started writing really early on. Like, I remember like making up little melodies and guitar things like almost as soon as I started playing. And it's weird. It was just like, it just was part of me. Like, I never thought like, oh, I want to be a songwriter or maybe I should try that. It just happened so naturally, man. You know, I just would come up with little ideas. And, I remember like being like, maybe, yeah, around the same age, 8, 9, 10 years old. and like getting going upstairs with my like boom box, you know, back then with my like couple CDs or whatever, and just like laying a blanket out on my room and sitting like Indian style with my guitar and just being like, all right, I'm going to write a song now. And like being super inspired by like, I think I had like a Steppenwolf album, a Led Zeppelin album, a Queen album. I definitely had AC/DC, Back in Black. Yeah. But it was
mailed to every American.
Yeah, yeah, dude, those mailing things. Remember those things?
10 CDs for a buck. You start, and they start raking you. Yeah.
That was it. That was totally it. That's how I got those CDs. But my cousin Bubba, Brendan Quinn, who's also a local musician from Scranton, one time we were at like a party, like an outdoor little picnic. My mom's friends were having like a picnic or something. And somebody started passing a guitar around. And dude, I came up with this riff that I still remember to this day. It's really cool. Like I would honestly still put it in a song like right now. And I was like, I don't know how it came about, but I started playing it for my cousin. I'm like, yeah, check this out. And dude, like his reaction was like, he was like, it was like priceless. Like, I guess I didn't realize kind of like, you know, like it was kind of how, you know, like it just seems so like such second nature for me to like write something like that. He was so blown away by it that his reaction almost like weirded me out. I was like, why is he reacting like this? And then I guess I started thinking, well, damn, I guess I'm a songwriter. Like, I guess I'm good at this, you know, I don't know. It's funny.
So with the story of addiction, the other story of expression and knowing with some kind of certainty, at least a path forward that you want to be a musician, you're going to be a musician, but addiction's kind of in tow to this wagon. When did you first start seeing signs that this can interrupt the life you may want?
Yeah. You know, man, this is like a, yeah. I mean, the whole thing, it's crazy now, like that I'm getting older and all this stuff is starting to actually make, not only make sense, but I'm also starting to completely accept like my path and what it was and what it is now and where it's heading. There was a long time where I was beating myself up because I mean, for lack of a better term, I really showed my ass. I mean, addiction, like on whatever type of public, you know, stage I was on, man, like there wasn't one person who didn't know that I had a drug problem, but maybe we could even get into that. But man, I will say that, well, my cousin Leah, you know, the one I just said that I played the old Friends reunion with, you know, yeah, she died of a drug overdose when she was 19 and I was 15. And that really, you know, did a number on our family. And I know for me personally, I was like, man, I'm not doing any hard drugs anymore, you know? Cause I had sniffed heroin with her twice when I was like 13, 14 years old, which is completely insane. But I didn't like get addicted at that point or anything like that. So I just sort of, you know, would smoke some weed and drink my beers in high school. But man, when I moved to Florida, I went to this school called Full Sail down in Florida. And, man, it was weird. I was just thinking about this the other day. Like my first like month or two there, it was like totally normal. Obviously, you know, I figured out real quick that when you grow up in Pittston or, you know, Scranton Wilkes-Barre area for lack of, you know, for that matter. I mean, dude, we were like professional partiers by like 10th grade.
Yeah.
Like really. And like when I got down there, I just assumed that like the other kids did that kind of stuff. And I quickly realized that like my roommates had never done like a keg stand or a beer bong or any of these like things that I was fully, you know, capable of doing in like ninth, you know, like we just started partying like so hard. And I sort of like kind of, I probably got like a kick out of the fact that I was like showing these, you know, these kids how to like party properly or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. But dude, yeah, we started doing a lot of cocaine, and then my one roommate brought heroin home. And dude, I don't know what happened inside my head, but I was drunk. I was so dead against doing heroin, like so dead against it. But I was already drunk. And my thought process, I'll never forget. There was a party going on at my house. There was a line of people going into the bathroom, which I assume was to do coke, which, you know, in Florida at a college party, I'm sure is going to be pretty readily available. And I like went to like, hey, you know, let me in on that. My one buddy was like, dude, wait, they're not doing coke. It's heroin. And in my drunken state, I was like, well, I did it before. What's one more time, you know? Sure. And man, I sniffed that bump of heroin. And dude, I woke up the next morning and was like, where did it come from? How much is it? Who do I have to call? How can I, like, it was like another switch went off in my head. And yeah, like, man, within 3 months, this is crazy, actually. Within 3 months of that day, those kids who I was living with and partying with had kicked me out of that apartment. I moved in with a stripper and I blew through every last saved dollar that I had, you know, to live off of at college. And I was already doing like all types of illegal activity to get money. It was, you know, it just got absolutely insane, like real fast.
That's fast. I guess if you would, just so I understand, let me summarize it. Full Sail, first off, is it's a school of art, right? Film and music.
Yeah, film, audio engineering, audio. Like video game stuff, marketing. Yeah, yeah.
Really high creative environment in Florida with a bunch of, you know, squares or the nerds. In yeah. comes the elder statesman who's already in midlife, if you're from Scranton. By the time your midlife crisis starts when you're 18. And this scenario rises up where you snort heroin in a drunken state, you know, a little more averse to risk. Let me try it. I've already done it. That was years ago. It must not be as addictive. It could be something social for me. When I hear that, I hear someone who's now getting dopamine from, say, alcohol, cocaine, lets you feel alert, makes connection, or at least conscious life not feel separate from rumination. And when you're not using, rumination is this unsaddled brain of thinking of the life that should, what are other people thinking, not being able to be present in a room because it's uncomfortable. And then in comes that snort of heroin. You know, both of those systems are two little different distinct systems in the brain to receive those two different tracks of drugs, dopamine and then the opioid reward system. And when you get addicted to heroin, the bonding happens not from so much physical pain, it's the emotional pain. The opioid reward system is just waiting there. You're soothing pain. And it might have been pain you can't even articulate. And that bonding is extremely, like, it's, that is addiction. Like, when you want to talk about it, maybe just as the physical or the neurological play, but resolving that physically doesn't solve the problem of addiction.
Dude, everything you just said, man, is so hit the nail on the, you know, like, dude, I still am like unveiling, like, the, you know, like going through the process of realizing like how uncomfortable I did feel in my own skin and like how being in a room full of people, I could still feel completely out of place. All those isms that we talk about, man, you know, dude, that bump of heroin on a belly full of beer. Just, dude, it did something. It fixed me. It literally stopped my brain. It completely, it was like, oh my God, I didn't know that I could feel, I could be okay. Like, really, dude. And like, this might sound crazy too, but I think it's relevant. You know, I was never one to like dig too much into like childhood or blaming or, sure, you know, like trying to figure out whose fault is it that I'm that. But dude,
sorry, Biz. I always tell newcomers to blame the sun. If we didn't have a ball of gas as our neighbor, none of this excitement would have started. Right. So you got someone to blame. Blame a fucking star.
Yeah. Right. But so check this out. So, dude, I don't know why I was like through therapy, like this became forefront of my mind. But like when I was in first grade, right, one time I got in trouble for doing something I didn't really even realize like I was doing anything wrong. Like, it's a silly story, but like the teacher like yelled at me and I had no idea like why I was being in trouble. Like and it terrified me, but, there was that situation. But another time, I think my cousin shaved his head And I wanted to shave my head too, because I thought he was super cool and he was older than me and I wanted to do everything he did. And I shaved my head. And I think like maybe I have a funny looking like head. I don't know. This is the last time I shaved my head, and I was 6 years old. And I went to school with, you know, like kids used to, right? Like kids shave their head, you know, like, or just cut your hair like real short, you know? And dude, the kids made fun of me. The kids in second grade called me alien. They were like in, you know, in the, like the lunch line, like alien, you know? And like, dude, I think that like was part of like, you know, the me starting to feel like uncomfortable in my skin, or like the world wasn't a safe place for me, or the, you know, maybe this will unravel a different way. And maybe it wasn't as big of a deal, but I remember like putting a guard up after that. And I remember being like, you know, like just sort of like scared. I don't know, man. I don't know.
No,
but when you do the bump of heroin, it fixes all of that.
Yeah, it does. And I think that's where families who have someone that is in severe addiction or seeing all these irrational consequences from an addiction, especially when it comes to heroin or opioids, like how did this happen? What they're not understanding is they're only seeing, you know, the tip of the iceberg. Like I see this actual problem of drug use, but you're not seeing, not everyone's a drug addict. And there's a very specific reason why this has happened. It's an attempt to solve that problem of not feeling like a fucking alien. Now, that's a distinct hazing and accusation. It's almost dehumanizing, because not only are you different, you're not our species. Like, that's
sure, yeah.
There's texture to that. And that could, two people could have the same event happen, and one walks away with trauma and one doesn't. And the one who doesn't already had connection. Now, it takes about 8 years for, you know, any mammal in the last 10,000 years to develop a personality. And personalities are developed by our role with others. Like you manifest it, you manufacture it by your position with other people, because you're only offering a personality to others. So when that feels rejected, you only create your true personality, I would venture to say, is this inner life. That's, you know, the intimacy is, it's too painful or scary or risky to share with other people. And a lot of that could be driven by an ego instead of an authentic self. That's where I, myself, I feel like I've experienced, that was my kind of interruption and what we can only assume would be a balanced life, homeostasis. And my addiction made that right. Like, and it was worth the consequences for a long time to take, okay, I'm just a drunk, but I know what it's like not to have alcohol. Fuck that.
Yeah. Dude. Yeah.
Your music kind of took off regionally, and you had a following, people loved it. When was these first kind of attempts at recovery or a failed attempt happening? How would you summarize that and how it related to what you were playing at the time, your own music?
Yeah, I mean, dude, it's a great, it's a cool story. Like, man, I ended up at Clearbrook, like, probably for like the third time. I really had burned it to the ground, you know, like really bad. Like it was like, you know, nowhere to live. You know, already been passed from family member to family member, robbed them, did horrible, unspeakable things to my family that I'm still, you know, not quite, you know, still processing. But I became willing to go to aftercare. They sent me to a halfway house down in Lititz, PA, ended up down there. All the isms of what we do when we're untreated, you know, when you take away my alcohol and drugs, I am left feeling like a raw nerve. And especially when you're living in a house with like 20 some guys. And I was grateful that, you know, I got introduced to like a 12-step program and ended up moving to York, Pennsylvania. And ended up, there was this golden age in York, PA, man. And the people that were living there know what it was like. That was like unlike anything I'd ever seen, man. The meetings were massive. The recovery community was massive. there was really, really, really good recovery there. And I got linked up with some people that really greatly altered the course of my life. And I was able to start living a productive, like I got a Tuesday night gig. This is actually a funny note, funny side note. I got a Tuesday night gig at this place in York where I played there every Tuesday night. And it was the first time I ever had like a solo gig, like a residency. And I sort of, you know, like cut my teeth and learn how to play and learn how to entertain a crowd at that place. But funny thing is when you're, you know, in recovery and all your friends are in recovery, like the bartenders in some of these places that I used to play would be like, they would be baffled after the night. They'd be like, you brought, there was 35 people here to see you play last night and every single one of them ordered a Sprite. Who are these people? You know, like they couldn't understand it. It was so funny, man. But man, I was able to start actually like getting on track and like pursuing some of my dreams and like started writing a lot. And man, I wrote some really, really cool songs in that first couple of years there when I was sober. And I remember I got my own apartment on Market Street in York, and I'd sit at my kitchen table and write songs. And those songs later became the East Hope Avenue album, which I still love. I mean, my voice sounds super young and you know, obviously there's stuff that I would change, but there's some really, really creative, cool ideas on that album, I think, for, you know, for like a, you know, yeah, whatever, just, you know, a songwriter. There's some pretty neat stuff on that album.
Yeah. Upwards and Onwards. Do you remember our first shoot was in the Marquee building, Marquee Art and Frame building before the coffee shop at Deza was there. It was empty.
Yeah, dude, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. We set up, we were going to do green screen and then we just shot it regular, with snowflake. Was it, snowflakes?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another funny side note. So like I knew who you were before then, cause I'd been like hanging at the open mic, like at the Bog, and I knew like, you know, Pat and, dude, this is actually kind of funny too, but like you were like, you're just a funny you know, like outward dude. And when I first met you and Pat, you were singing the Chris Isaak song at the Bog.
That's my, I'm a one trick pony, man. That's what I got. And
dude, I so thought you were like smash drunk. Like I had no idea that you were sober, which makes it so much better, like so much funnier.
Oh yeah. That open mic will never return. That was like 10 years of just like six variations of classes, a freshman to a senior year class of all kinds of people just going down there from stand-up, poetry, music, jams, like people, there was no set. People just sat on the stage and picked something up. And that place was all that was awesome. That crew that was going down there. I mean, they could jam, they'd be playing till 4 a.m, just ripping.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was fun. So Miz, I want to kind of almost come quickly to current events without a slow draw. How long have you been in Nashville now?
It's crazy. It'll be 5 years in a couple weeks, actually. I moved here January like 4th or 5th, I think, right after New Year's in 2019.
So you moved down. You've had periods of sobriety. We've both experienced that and treatments, and you're going down there out of opportunity. You're a musician. What was the initial draw down there and where was your head, with recovery when you arrived in Nashville?
Yeah. So amazing story, man. So could I say the name of a treatment center or is that like not?
No, this is an open book here. You could say whatever you want.
Well, dude, I mean, you know, there was a guy named Andy Pace who, and he doesn't run it anymore, but was running this place called Little Creek. And dude, he saved my life. Like literally, man, when at the start of this podcast, when you and I were talking about, you know, like you were like talking me into going to long-term treatment, I end up at Little Creek for 3 months. And the kids that, dude, it's so funny. Cause it's a young men's facility. And I was 33 and my first night there, the friggin' kids nicknamed me Middle-Aged Mike. Middle-Aged
Mike. Well, Mike, if it comforts you, I just left a provider's meeting. Guess who the presenter was? Little Creek. And the average stay there is now guys in their 30s. So,
oh, wow. That's Well, dude, I was
middle-aged Mike.
Dude, it was one of those things where it was a really hit you between the eyes type of situation where I was like, holy crap, I'm not the young guy in treatment anymore. Like, this is weird. So anyway, I'm keep giving you these long answers, but Andy was the one that was like, hey, Mike, you should think about going to Nashville. And dude, it's so funny. I was like,
wow.
I was like, Nashville, I don't want to move to Nashville. Like, and then I ended up staying there and completing the treatment. I was like working on this album and dude, he was like, you should go down there for a week. He's like, I'm going to help you out. He sent me down here for a week, man. Like the guy.
He's a special guy. He really is. He's a very special.
And it's like, he could see, he could see it better than I could or whatever. And I came down and there's this other guy, Bob Lewis, that is from our area. That's, not in recovery or anything. Just like kind of regular. Actually he did, out of just the choice, he's sober now too. But obviously didn't have, problems like you or I did, but, he was living down here. And so I linked up with him and dude, it just quickly became apparent that, that I wasn't getting any younger and that if I wanted to kind of move forward, listen, man, there's no judgment. Like I had a really good life in Pennsylvania. Right. And I was playing some cool places and I could have done really well for myself up there, but I knew it was one of those crossroads where I was also dating a really wonderful person at the time, who I'd broken up with when I met you in treatment. And then we got back together and, I think we were probably back together about a year or so. And I just realized that I think we were kind of wanting to go two different paths in life. And we had a very mature, mutual, cool breakup that was very not dramatic and was just hey, you're going this way and I'm going this way and I wish you the best. And it was totally cool. And she's, all her dreams are, coming true now.
She's a doctor now, right? Or something, isn't there?
No, nothing like that. I mean, she's, you might be thinking of somebody else, but she has a family and got married and seems to have just wonderful people around her. And I'm really happy for her. But I, in turn, once that relationship ended, I knew that it was my window. I was like, this is it. Like if I don't go right now, I'm never going to go again. And dude, other than getting sober, moving down here was the greatest decision I've ever made in my entire life. I am so happy that I did it. Wow. Man, I couldn't even begin to tell you.
Do you have a sense of home now? It's 5 years. Like you feel, you know, the magnetism just from being a mammal that you're kind of home. Because I've been to places and I've lived in places for certain periods of times where I've still felt upside down.
Yeah.
Would you say Nashville feels like home now?
Yeah, dude, it's definitely, man. I live here in East Nashville again. I was on the other side of town for a year and a half and moved back and dude, it's definitely home. Yeah. It's, I don't know if I'm going to grow old here, I don't know if I'll be wanting to live here when I'm in my 70s or whatever. I probably want to maybe live somewhere a little more scenic and beautiful or in the mountains or something. But for right now, yeah, man, this is definitely home. I feel super at home here.
The Grand Ole Opry. Tell me about it. What is this place?
Grand Ole Opry?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's funny. Here, dude, let me just be really honest with you, right? I never listened to country music.
No Cash or Hank Jr.
Well, dude, of course I liked Merle Haggard, Johnny Cash, and Waylon, of course. And listened to the popular songs by those guys.
Sure.
And I love Marty Robbins too. But as far as modern country music, I mean, dude, when Froggy 101 would come on, I mean, I couldn't change the channel fast enough. I mean, I'm just being honest. Now it's weird because I know a lot of the people that are playing on those songs and stuff. You know what I mean?
Weird.
My one buddy, I could always tell it's him. I'm like, oh, that's Saul. He plays on all that stuff, and I could hear it a lot of the time. I just heard him the other night. I was at this ice skating thing, weirdly enough, at the Opry. There you go. At Opryland. But Grand Ole Opry is awesome, man. I live with this guy. I live above this guy, Bruce Boughton. Avmon Place, who is, you know, look him up. He's one of the most legendary pedal steel players of all time. And he played last night at the Bluebird with this guy who has one of the craziest repertoire of songs I've ever heard. Like, you know, like 25 number one hits, and has just, dude, he just wrote a song for Ringo. And the band director and the piano player from the Grand Ole Opry was there, and they were talking about, they just recorded this track for like Ringo to sing on. And it was, man, it was so cool just sitting there listening to these guys talk about that stuff, you know. But
and Miz, would these guys be considered like the studio players of Nashville, like the labor force of the music scene of Nashville? How would you describe that to just a conventional listener? What is going on in this city when it comes to studio players, gigs? Why is it uniquely different than the rest of the country?
Oh, dude, there's nothing like it, man. There's absolutely nothing like it. Here's the thing. It takes a while. And for me, obviously, there was a pandemic in the middle. So it probably equals about 3.5 years rather than 5, you know? Mm-hmm. We were all locked down and stuff. But, man, right now it is the land of opportunity, man. It's unbelievable. Like, there's the whole scene of songwriters, right? And like publishers and people getting publishing deals and people that their goal is to write songs for other people to cut. And that's a whole world, which I've kind of dipped my toes in. I actually have 2 songs coming out on a major label here in the next couple months on Big Loud that I co-wrote. And, you know, Joey Moy, who's one of the biggest producers in the world, is like loves these 2 songs I wrote. So I kind of dip my toes in that world. That's kind of starting to pay off. And then there's the people who want to be artists who are often playing like songwriter rounds and doing all that stuff, but more trying to get record deals or, you know, trying to, you know, do the whole artist thing, right? Like, you know, build a team, get a good manager, all those things, booking agent. And then there's the studio musicians who are like wizards, man. These guys that play on a lot of pop country and a lot of other stuff, man, are some of the greatest musicians in the world that you've probably never heard of, but they're literally like wizards, man. Like the guy, you know, who I stay up above here. I got a really sweet spot here in Inglewood. He's played on the biggest record, like, dude, he played on all the Garth Brooks, all those massive mm-hmm. Shania Twain records. It's funny for me, cause like, you know, Northeast PA, like used to hang out at Gin's, you know, like up there in Factoryville, and all the songs that would come on the radio, like Boot Scoot and Boogie and all these, like, dude, he played on all this. Like, I know the parts, you know what I mean? It's so funny.
That's got to feel like you're living in history, like in the sense that even when I was out in LA or going to film festivals, to feel like, holy shit, like my favorite part of history is entertainment, or, well, you know, at those times to be in Nashville, a music, and starting to hear someone's riff that you were just with. That's a fun life. That's an interesting life. Not everyone's afforded that opportunity, or at least given the clarity to go after it. Like, this is what I want to do. Is that a source of gratitude for you all the time that you got to pursue this?
Dude, this morning I woke up, I have a porch, a nice little porch here where the sun comes up in the morning. And I sat out there and I do the Wim Hof breathing. I don't know if you know about Wim Hof.
Sure do.
Love that guy. Love doing that. And dude, I was flooded by such a sense of gratitude that my life is where it is. Like, I wouldn't want to be in any other place. I don't want to be any other person. I'm so grateful to be where I'm at right now, man. And like, it's a huge source of gratitude. And like, real quick too, sorry, the dog's going to start barking here. I might have to let him out. But the one thing that's crazy for me, and it ties in with Andy Pace and it ties in with getting sober, is that, dude, when you start following that feeling in your gut, like when you know, when getting sober allows you to like be aware of like your intuition and what your gut's telling you to do, like amazing things happen. Cause like when I first moved here, man, my living situation got turned upside down at the last minute. I moved in with this guy who I didn't know, named Boo Ray, who's like an outlaw country singer. And then I ended up writing a record with him. And I moved into the old bedroom of a guy named Saul Littlefield, who's now one of the biggest session guitar players in town. He had just played on all the Luke Combs stuff and was blowing up. And so he moved out and, you know, got his own place. And then I quickly linked up with him. And the chain of events, man, that followed, like leading up to this very day and leading up to the record that I just put out, it's incredible, man. Like, it's absolutely incredible. Like, you know, and I don't really talk about this too much, and I wanted to like explain it in a better way, but like, man, that record I did, you know, that I released earlier this year, like just to get to do that and get to play with those musicians. I mean, just the cast of characters like on that album, like these guys are like my heroes, you know, like, sorry, the dog's making, he wants to go out. Lay down for 1 minute, bud. Sorry.
Well, it's, we're getting almost to the hour, and I want to, yeah. And I'd love to talk to you again. So you're living, breathing, working musician in a mecca of some of the world's greatest history of music, studio recordings, and American sounds. Let's rewind 1 second. You're 4 years sober. You pursued a dream. You're working in the city that's making that happen, and your talent carried you. There was a time where you did not feel that way, that you were in a treatment center, be it with me or someone else, where you feel totally defeated. And you had a lot to express, even in the midst of an active addiction or early recovery. What would you say to a young musician that's 22, 33, and feels completely fucking crushed and defeated? Why would you tell them not to quit the idea of music or recovery if they were a creative type? What do you have to offer them?
I love that question, Joe. I think for me, a lot of times, you know, people that meant well would, and just by, I think they meant well, but a lot of times when I would get sober in my early 20s and I would tell people I wanted to be a musician, they would be like, oh, you better pick a different career. You better go pull out that, you know, you better go learn how to be a roofer. And it would crush me inside. Cause dude, I never wanted to do anything else. I'm one of the lucky people. I knew what I wanted to do, you know, since I was a little kid, there was no question. And so now that I feel like a tide has turned in the recovery community, I feel like it's better understood that one of the biggest things that I learned that I am grateful that I was taught was that when you're spiritually fit and when you take care of the problems that need to be taken care of, and when you, you know, if it's a 12-step program or whatever your path is, you can go anywhere in the world. You know, I didn't get sober to hide under a rock, and I certainly didn't get sober to not pursue my one true passion in life. And man, when I had met you, Joe, dude, this is crazy. I know I talk a lot, but when I had met you, I was on the run, not when I met you, but when we were in treatment together, I was on the run from the state of New Jersey. I had warrants for my arrest. I literally had left the state. I had been arrested 4 times in a row. I was arrested with 16 bags of heroin standing in front of a school. That was one of my charges. And I, you know, like, dude, the things that were like, the level of hopelessness that I had felt, my girlfriend broke up with me, the law was after me, I was definitely going to jail. The way that I felt inside that day, man, if there's someone else that like feels like that right now, oh my God, if I could just like give them just a fraction of what I like, the hope and peace and, you know, fulfillment that I feel in my life right now, man, to just stick it out and just put one foot in front of the other, man. It's so worth it to get sober, man. No matter. And dude, I've been to rehab 13 times. So like if it, you know, dude, sometimes it takes 13 times. Mm-hmm. You just can't give up. You cannot give up.
Dude, I thank you for that. And, you know, as we're closing this, I just want to give you insight or a theory of mine of how I've always viewed you and how I viewed you in rehab. When I would see you struggling outside, or you saw me struggling, I was sober 14 years. I've always viewed you as a winner. And what's a winner? What do I mean by that? A person who cares about people. You get as lost as me, but you always had a heart. If you could see the way you look to other people, even in your worst moments, I always thought you were a really warm, gentle and kind person, even what you described from that. And I think that comes through in your music. I was really happy to catch up with you today, and I hope we could do this again. I was looking forward to it. And if anyone wants to see you down in Nashville, you can find Miz on Facebook, his Instagram. All his gigs are up there. Some beautiful pictures. Unbelievable shows have been happening now in the last 3 years that just make me smile.
Well, thanks, man. And right back at you, Joe.
Yeah. So I'll be in touch. I'll grab you if anything's coming up the pike or anything exciting that we could talk about. Let's jump back on.
Man, I would love to anytime. I'm really happy. You know, it's awesome to see what you're doing, man. And it's so cool to both be on the other side of this thing now, you know, and be able to share and give somebody else some hope. So
no doubt. I'll talk to you soon, Miz. Love you, man.
Okay. Love you, buddy.
I'd like to thank you for listening to another episode of All Better. You can find us on allbetter.fm. Or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Alexa. Special thanks to our producer, John Edwards, and engineering company 570 Drone. Please like or subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And if you're not on social media, you're awesome. Looking forward to seeing you again. And remember, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're right. Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you.